time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 13 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna and I will be your host as always. Today's episode will be called Racism as Riot. And oftentimes the thing we're speaking about, the race riots of 1919, are referred to as race riots. However, Peter Fryer, who wrote the amazing and incredible book Staying Power, about the history of black people in Britain, his subtitle of his chapter detailing this is called Racism as Riot 1919, and I think it makes more sense for it to be referred to as that, as opposed to race riots, because race riots are often the name given to any kind of protest that spirals out of control in regards to black people and white people, or different ethnic groups of people clashing with white people due to their racism, and I think it's probably more appropriate to refer to it as racism as a riot, because that's exactly what it was. And we'll get into the episode shortly. This episode will contain violence and death and things of that nature, so may not be suitable for younger audiences, just as a content warning. However, I will, you know, try my best to make it as upbeat as possible. But the thing is, with black history in Britain, it tends to be sometimes quite violent, especially in regards to riots and the backlash that black communities faced in Britain from white British people and other white people, actually, as we'll get into this episode. So, following on from last episode, where we ended up at the end of World War One, and we were thinking about some of those men that served during World War One, today we will be looking at the aftermath of World War One, especially in regards to black British seamen and seafarers that were kind of left in Britain at the end of the war with not much to do, which you'd be thinking, why? You know, the ex-servicemen, they've given their, you know, time, their energy, their efforts to Britain to fight this worthy cause in this great war. Some have lost their lives, many have lost limbs, and here they are in Britain, you know, wanting to continue their work, seafaring. But unfortunately, nobody wanted to hire black people anymore. And the war was won, and Britain had decided that they didn't really need black people anymore. So that wartime boom for black labour fizzled out as quickly as it had begun, in the words of Peter Fryer. So the companies that were hiring people to do that kind of work after the war, they would prioritise the labour of white people. And that wasn't just white British people, it was also like white Scandinavian people and people who were kind of left over, essentially, not necessarily British people, but were left over after fighting the war and still in Britain and looking for work. And so there were unions, and the unions were, you know, not really there to support the black men. They were there to ensure that white people had work, essentially. And so they were left kind of destitute, black people, the ex-servicemen. They were left without jobs, they were left without anywhere to live because they had no money. And a lot of them would pawn their clothes off to get enough money to eat or to find lodging for a night. Many were homeless, many were crippled because they had lost limbs in the war. And they were kind of in an impossible situation where nobody would hire them. And so they couldn't get any money, so that they couldn't really go back to even the countries that they were from initially, because they didn't have money for the fare. There were like drives to repatriate some of them. I think that's where the government would pay for their fare back to their home countries, but that wasn't the case. And obviously right after, at the end of the war, that wasn't really a priority, because there were probably bits of Britain that needed to be rebuilt. This impacted a lot of the port cities, so Cardiff, Liverpool, I think Glasgow gets a mention here in regards to these riots that, come in the aftermath of this kind of excess black labour who can't work and can't get jobs. I thought I would read out a letter to the Colonial Office from William P. Samuels, who was a seaman who was stranded in Cardiff from British Guiana originally, who had, fought in the war, or not necessarily fought on the front lines, but as a seaman, as a seafarer, so on a naval ship, whether that was, doing different jobs on a naval ship. His letter reads, "We kindly beg to appeal to you for justice. We are seafaring men that have served this country faithfully in her past difficulties, either in the services of His Britannic Majesty or in mercantile marine. The places of our birth are surely British possessions or protectorates, and here in Great Britain, which is the capital of the British Empire, we are badly treated by the British people. We do not want any favour. All we want is fair play. Every morning we go down to shipping offices to find ourselves work, so as to make an honest bread, and are bluntly refused on account of our colour, whereas foreigners of all nationality get the preference. This is not only in Cardiff, but throughout the United Kingdom. What is the British motto? Are we not men and brothers whom Christ died for? Why take such filthy advantages of men who have done you no wrong? Is it because we have no one to fight our cause? Why treat us as mere brutes? Is it because we are mere dogs, which neither bark nor bite? No, sir, we are men, men that gives the British Empire little or no trouble. We kindly ask to step before foreigners on any British ship." So just to give a quick analysis of that letter from William P. Samuels to the Colonial Office, he starts saying, we kindly beg to appeal for your justice. He wants justice. He has obviously just fought in the war, and now he's appealing to the Colonial Office for better treatment in Britain. We're badly treated by the British people, he says. We don't want favour, we just want fair play. He ends the letter talking about, in the extract that I have, where he asks, "We kindly ask to step before foreigners on any British ship." And I think that's alluding to the idea that there were European people in Britain who were also seafarers that were getting preferential treatment, and that was due to their whiteness, because the issue wasn't with working with foreigners, it was working with black people. That was what white British people had issue with, which then it kind of, I guess, solidifies the fact that race was a problem and not nationality, as some people would like to argue that, oh yeah, it's because, maybe they were different, they're from a different place. Well, no, they were British citizens. They had just served Britain in the war, yet other European people were having preferential treatment over that, and they weren't happy with that at all. And then he notes that, it's not just in Cardiff where he's obviously based, it's in other cities, and we will look at Liverpool as our kind of main place to understand these race riots and to understand how widespread they were and how big of a problem the surplus of black labour became in Britain after the First World War, which is quite a different narrative in some ways to after the Second World War, where there is I guess more of a demand for a wider range of black people to fix Britain's country. So following the end of World War One in Liverpool, there was a lot of job dissatisfaction amongst white workers who, obviously, the amount of available work after a war is obviously not as much as during the war, especially as a seaman. And so there became like a resentment of the presence of black people and black labour there. And also there was an element of these black people, especially there were majority black men. I don't really think I know of any black women. I don't want to write them out because history does that enough. But the presence was mostly black men, and there was kind of this idea that there was a threat essentially to white masculinity, because relationships began to occur with black men and white women, and that common narrative of, oh, stealing our jobs, stealing our women, stealing our houses, that came up again. And there was just a lot of dissatisfaction between, I'd say, white men especially those who were looking to work as seafarers and that sort of thing, and would have been working and living in Liverpool to do so. So the black population of the city obviously grew due to ex-servicemen kind of finding themselves there after the war and the black seafarers that were discharged. So it kind of rose between, estimates say, between 2,000 and 5,000, which obviously isn't that, you know, big in today's terms when we look at the size of some of Britain's major cities. However, at that time, to see that many black faces was obviously quite a big issue. So a significant portion of them would obviously have been unemployed, and white workers were refusing to work alongside of black workers. And so a kind of, I guess, a colour bar essentially was imposed, supported by trade unions who also backed white workers' decisions and demands to not have to work with black people. And so that just led to obviously less and less black people being hired in these roles. And so, as I said before, many couldn't return home, they couldn't work, they couldn't eat, and they were destitute. A lot of them were essentially homeless. I think in Liverpool there was a report that said around 500 to 600 black men, mostly discharged British soldiers and sailors, were out of work, stranded in the area and anxious to go home. Some practically starving, had been obviously refused work on account of their colour. You know, there was calls for the colonial office to repatriate them and allow them to go back home and pay for that and fund that. However, that obviously hadn't happened yet. But the mayor also received complaints about, you know, the fact that there were about 5,000 jobless white ex-servicemen who were not happy with the presence of black workers. I think that, to me, it sounds like they must have been bored because they didn't have jobs. You know, they're probably struggling for money. We've just had a war. And so now the presence of these black workers who aren't actually black workers because they're struggling to find work or not being allowed to work are causing them a problem for whatever reason. Well, we know what the reason is: racism. And so there's a lot of tension in Liverpool in regards to race, and the police obviously had to be part of this story. They are always there when there is racial tension. They're like orchestrators of it. I feel like there's not been one podcast episode where I've spoken about negative race relations and the police haven't popped up somewhere. We're not talking about the London Metropolitan Police today. We're talking about Liverpool. Liverpool police, they did very little to lessen the tension, obviously. Why would they? Instead, they just harassed black men who were allegedly running an illegal gambling house. Sounds very much mangrovey to me. But are we surprised? Absolutely not. So the police, who are obviously there to protect, you know, to look after the population, obviously have their own prejudices about black people and are acting on them. They also might feel similar to some of the white ex-servicemen who are now jobless and, you know, also looking for work. And so we get to May 1919, so the war ended November 1918, so this is, you know, a good few months on from that. And on the 4th of June, in May, there were just a lot of attacks on black men, essentially. White people were just simply attacking them, and this was obviously leading to fights because, you know, they weren't necessarily going to take it lying down, and so they would try and support each other, even though some of them were crippled and had, you know, singular limbs. They tried to kind of physically support each other, get involved in the fights, but they just kept happening again and again. And so on the 4th of June, two Scandinavians, as I said, it wasn't just white British people, it was kind of a whole wider spectrum of white people. They stabbed a West Indian man, John Johnson, because he refused to give them a cigarette. That level of entitlement is absolutely beyond me, but I think that just kind of shows you the power of whiteness at that time, and the fact that they knew that they could probably get away with something like that with very few repercussions, to stab someone over not giving them a cigarette. But trust me, I think we can all understand and know that if John Johnson was white British and not West Indian, he wouldn't have been stabbed over something like that. And if he had, justice in some degree would have been served. Anyway, he was severely wounded in the face and the news spread quickly. The next evening, his friends, eight of them, went to a pub that the Scandinavians used, threw beer over a group of them, attacked them with sticks, knives, razors and pieces of sharp iron taken from lampposts. They knocked unconscious a policeman who tried to stop them. Five Scandinavians were taken to hospital. Only one was detained, even though the night before they had stabbed John Johnson. And in an effort to then arrest the black people that had gone to retaliate, they raided boarding houses used by the black seamen in Liverpool, because some of them obviously could afford to maybe find somewhere to stay. Not necessarily all of them were on the streets. They would have hostels and boarding houses where they would live and share rooms and pay kind of a small amount of rent, as opposed to like renting a house, which not many people did. Not many black people in those days anyway would have been able to afford to do. Obviously the jobs weren't there. So this raid took place on the 5th of June 1919, and one of the houses raided was 18 Upper Pitt Street, and there lived a 24-year-old ship's fireman who is said to be Bermudian and Trinidadian, called Charles Wooten. He had been discharged from the Navy the previous March, and he, when the house was raided, he ran from the house. I would probably argue in fear, although nobody had his account of the evening of the night. He ran out in fear. He was chased by two policemen, but also a mob of about 300 people, white people, who were hurling missiles and stones at him. He wasn't actually involved in the retaliation attack on the Scandinavian men. He, I think, ran out in fear, and then was obviously pursued, and thought to be guilty, or maybe it's the fact that a black man is running and these jobless people wanted to take out their frustrations on black people, and so pick Charles Wooten. So off they went. They chased him. They caught him on the edge of, I think it's Queen's Dock or King's Dock. I've actually read conflicting information. I've read both, essentially, in accounts of this. Either way, a body of water. And they caught him on the edge. There are conflicting accounts. There's accounts that say the lynch mob, they tore him down from where he was kind of, not necessarily hiding, but standing, and threw him into the water. And there's other accounts that he ran into the water to flee. And apparently the mob were shouting, "Let him drown, let him drown." They pelted him with stones as he swam around. And it's said to have been the case that one hit him in the head and killed him. And he died in the water. His corpse was dragged out by police later that night. And no arrests were made. And you're probably thinking, well, that escalated very quickly, because that essentially was a public lynching, very similar to the ones that kind of happen in America that are said to be a problem that only America historically faced. And, well, I say historically, but they're still happening now. This obvious lynching was not, you know, a man tied to a tree, as scenes have been depicted in America, but he was chased into a body of water and stoned until he died. His body was lifeless and limp, being pulled out of the water. Sorry, I said this would be upbeat, but there's absolutely nothing upbeat that I can actually, nothing I can do to make a public lynching of a black man who has just served in World War One in the Royal Navy, the British Royal Navy, upbeat. There is nothing but disgust. That is the only thing that I can feel about this situation, and more so the fact that this is not something I knew about. This is not something I was taught in school. This is not something we think about when we remember all those people that gave their life to fight for Britain, despite the fact that, you know, they weren't from necessarily Great Britain as the country. They were from a colony or from another part of the world. They still were happy to give their lives. They gave limbs. And this was the response that they were given. This is the thanks that they received. They were lynched. Yeah. I kind of wish that was the end of the story and we would find out who threw the stones that killed Charles Wooten and who were the police officers, and we would know all that information and they would be held accountable. But, you know, as you can assume, they weren't. I think the case, like, went to be heard in a court and it was just, like, dismissed within, like, a day. Not really a big deal, according to people in Liverpool in 1919. And it's only kind of more recently, I say more recently, not necessarily like now, but, you know, in the past like years, that these stories have been brought to light, because in 1919 it has been recorded in newspapers. There are, you know, archives that have found reports of the lynching of Charles Wooten. It's not referred to as a lynching. It is there in the historical records, but little has been made of it, when you think about how significant it was. So the riots, you know, we haven't even got into them yet. They were kind of, I think they were, you could say they started with Charles Wooten in a sense, and the events of the days before. Because I don't know if that was like fuel to the fire of these racist mobs, but they came out at night in gangs, well-organised gangs, as been described by quite a few historians. Their strength varied from around 2,000 to 10,000. I said 10,000. That's 10,000 angry white men, maybe women as well, that were coming out to hunt black people. And to just kind of cause a fray and riot and discomfort and tension and violence on the streets of Liverpool. People had to be rehomed. Women and children were rehoused in like temporary places because the violence was so bad. Can you imagine 10,000 people? They attacked, beat up, stabbed like all the black people that they could find. And as I said at the start, some black people were homeless at the time. Because they didn't have anywhere to live after the war with no income. They were chased, beaten. And these are recorded in newspapers of the time, such as the Times. And so, you know, we have actual record of this type of thing. You know, they'd hunt them down in the streets. Black people obviously tried to fight back. But, you know, the numbers weren't really in their favour. As we said, it was around 2,000 to 5,000 black men, and don't get me wrong, I doubt they would have all been available to fight, especially as ex-servicemen who have lost potentially limbs. Mentally, they might not have been in good places because, you know, we know war has a detrimental effect on mental health. Whilst that wouldn't necessarily have been recorded or diagnosed at the time, you can imagine the state of these men that were involved in this. Yeah, they were wrecking houses, looting, setting the homes of black people on fire, and the lodging houses and boarding houses as well, and hostels, essentially just trying to find as many black people as possible and harm them or kill them if they could. So as we wrap this episode up, I wanted to go into maybe some of the newspapers and the editorial comments about the riots that were being published at the time. Now, you know, there were about 10,000 white people mobbing in the streets, but I'm sure you're aware. I'm sure you've guessed it, that it was black people that were blamed by the media for these problems and for these riots. I'll read out one. This is taken from the Liverpool Courier, and it's demanded the stern punishment of black scoundrels. The article, I've taken this from Peter Fryer's Staying Power. He uses an excerpt from the Liverpool Courier just to give him his credit, because I have not been searching the Liverpool Courier archives. So it reads, "One of the chief reasons of popular anger against the present disturbances lies in the fact that the average Negro is nearer the animal than is the average white man, and that there are women in Liverpool who have no self-respect. The white man regards the black man as part child, part animal, and part savage. It is true that many of the blacks in Liverpool are of a low type, that they insult and threaten respectable women in the street and that they are invariably unpleasant and provocative. I just find it awfully, awfully interesting that when these black men that were part child, part animal, part savage were fighting in the war, nobody was describing them as part child, part animal, part savage. Everybody was all happy that they were helping win the war. Anyway. So in the Manchester Guardian, it was reported that the people here understand the Negroes. They know that most of them are only big children who, when they get money, like to make a show. The Negroes would not have been touched, but for their relations with white women. This has caused the entire trouble. So both of these accounts have linked back to this idea of white men complaining that, you know, black people are taking their women. Very interesting. It's a common theme that comes up and is spoken about. And obviously the idea of mixed race children is still a huge problem at that point. It's a huge problem for decades after that. But, you know, then the fact that black men and white women were having relationships, sexual relationships, was clearly a big issue that needed 10,000 men to go and riot about. Very interesting to me. And so we get on to our final comment of the evening. This magistrate must have been, you know, he had his glasses on this day. We thank heavens. Although there's not really much to be thankful about in this situation, I can't lie. You know, the local magistrate said, "It was the white mobs which were making the name of Liverpool an abomination and a disgrace to the rest of the country." To that, Mr. Magistrate, I completely agree. The fact that there were publications that were even trying to pin this issue on black people to degrade them into being less than human or big children, absolutely disgusting considering nothing. As human beings, there is absolutely no need or reason to be degrading people into animalistic status, let alone people that have just fought for you in the war. And it's always this thing of, like, we measure how people should be treated by their contribution. Well, not today. Even though these people made a phenomenal contribution to this country, they shouldn't have been treated, even if they'd done nothing, they shouldn't have been treated like that. Lynch mobs. Have you ever heard of lynch mobs in Britain? No, haven't. It's definitely been erased from the narrative, and I would like that to be taught. I'd like everything to be taught, but I'm not in charge yet. So that essentially sums up the quote-unquote race riots in 1919. There were way more than just Liverpool. As I said, similar problems were happening across Britain, not just the country. So in Cardiff, in Glasgow, I believe, and in other port cities. So in summary, this has been quite a big episode in regards to, you know, in insane events we've had, or we've talked about the lynching of Charles Wooten by a mob of 200 to 300 and police officers that were present, and nothing was done about that. And then you've got the nights and nights of mobbing and rioting and fighting and looting and arson and violence orchestrated by these white mobs, and the blame that is then put on black men, black ex-servicemen, who essentially just want to work or go home. They don't want to be destitute. They don't want to be selling their clothes to pay for food. They don't want to be sleeping on the streets or in these hostels. But that's the situation they have found themselves in at the close of the war. And I think it just kind of goes to show just how black people were treated after the war, after their service to this country. And it's a common narrative. It's nothing new, even though we're going all the way back to 1919. I say all the way back, this is some early history for me. But it's the same story and the same, you know, thing of black people coming to this country to serve this country and being treated so horrendously. This case is obviously significantly more violent and tragic than maybe we have seen with the Windrush generation. However, it just kind of reigns clear what the British people, governments, empire felt about their black subjects. That is all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll be back next week where we will be talking about immigration and some of the immigration acts of the past that have shaped the way we view immigration today. So please do come back next week, and I hope you have a wonderful week. Thanks for listening. Bye.